As I get closer to where he went off the road, I see a big black shape in the middle of the road walking. So I have to slam on my brakes and try to swerve myself because this thing is walking in the center of the road. Because I don't see a head and I don't see arms. I just see a really big, tall person, like big, thick legs and a big, thick torso. And they're moving very funny.
And they count it between 35 and 40 infant and juvenile Bigfoot prints.
What I can tell you right now is you're telling me things that you can't find on YouTube or you can't find on any books. You have to be a researcher in the field to know certain things that are not out there to kind of, and you're hitting all the things that are not out there. I can tell you right now, you're not crazy. And she goes, yeah, you're legit a generational abductee.
They kept getting run off at night by these big balls of light, these globe balls of light that would basically chase them out if they were there too late. And then one night, he was there late, everybody else had left, and he could hear something walking around the dig area. And he could hear something following him. There were enormous wolf tracks that had followed him down. And what's really strange to begin with is there were no wolves back in the 70s, 80s. I mean, even now they're really rare in southern Utah. But they followed, and this wolf had followed him down to his car. And when he'd left, it turned and started out through the sagebrush into the desert, and they followed it. Right before their eyes, they're following this wolf track. It transformed into a barefoot human track and continued on to the desert.
And when that happened, everything just fell apart. Everything that I had believed in, all the rules that I had lived by, it was just like falling into a pit.
Back to the Verbal Echo podcast. I know it's been a minute. I apologize, but I'm pretty excited. Tonight, I'm releasing the second half of this amazing interview I had with Dr. John Baranchuk. He came on a couple months ago, and this interview ended up being really extensive and long, and so I split it in two, but here is the second half. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the first half, I encourage you to go back and take a peek at that. It's pretty incredible. He shares his experience out in the field, and we're going to dive into it even further tonight. So Dr. John Baranchuk is a clinical psychologist. He's got years of experience in neuropsychology. But he's not just theorizing from an office, he's out in the field. He's applying scientific methods to investigate one of the most elusive legends out there. He's written a book called Grasping Sasquatch, Prepping for Scientific Field Research. He's no stranger to being a guest on numerous podcasts, including Bigfoot Club, Uncomfortable Podcast, and Bigfoot and Beyond with the legends Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay. All right, so let's get into it. Here's the second half of this amazing interview with Dr. John Baranchuk. Cryptid, science, maybe a little psychology. All right, let's do it.
And so I think if you want to be really an objective Bigfoot researcher, I think you got to be open to all possibilities, especially because we've done so little experimental science on all of those theories. I don't think there's adequate evidence to support or refute any of them, frankly. So I think we've got to remain open to all possibilities and begin to investigate that. I think we've got stuck in a rut with flesh and blood because it's easy to collect the evidence. You can go out in the picture forest and take pictures and do recordings, and you're doing research. And you are doing fundamental research, but not research that's going to move the science forward. So I think we got to move the science forward with experimentation, but I think we got to cross-fertilize and look at all theoretical possibilities rather than just one because it's convenient.
Yeah, I want to bounce off of that. When you think about what a human being is, and we are talking about possibly a bipedal branch of some type of hominid.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about what a human is, we are more than just skin and bones. We have this mm-hmm. deeply spiritual side to us. We do have the ability to use our minds in ways that we can't quantify. And I was instantly thinking about Dr. Evan Laszlo and his research on random number generators and a human's ability to affect the playing out of number, like affecting ones and zeros in these controlled experiments. So I think that there have been controlled experiments, but then we go back to how do you get funding to do all that? Yeah. To pay for the office and pay for the equipment and pay for the subjects, you know, and you have to get somebody that believes in it, you know, or you have to convince someone to get the funding to do those sort of things. So I think that there have been some research, legitimate research is done. And then you think about the human's ability to do like Reiki healing and energy work and this sort of thing. And it has a very causal effect on the recipient.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to say that. And then you also mentioned infrasound, and you gave a really exceptional example of infrasound with the elephants and how the zookeepers were affected by this ability. And Bigfoot has been associated with possibly being able to create infrasound. And so I was wondering if you could explain that a little bit and what Sure. infrasound really is.
Sure. I'm forgetting how many hertz or megahertz. Infrasound is basically a very low, deep sound frequency that is not audible to the human's ears, but is still present. And it's been discovered that elephant herds 10 miles apart from each other can trumpet and make infrasound that will travel underground that 10 miles and then be picked up by the pads of the other elephant's feet. And elephant herds can 10 miles apart then can communicate with each other, even though they can't hear the audible sound of the trumpeting that we hear 10 miles away. That infrasound travels underground 10 miles and they can communicate that way. But infrasound, it's such a low and intense frequency. I'm embarrassed that I can't tell you the frequency. I did a whole show on it. But if you're chronically exposed to infrasound, sound waves of this certain frequency, it can damage your organs. So zookeepers have to be rotated onto a new task away from the elephants every 2.5 to 3 months, because if they don't get away from the elephants, just working for the elephants that long and being around their trumpeting and infrasound that goes with it, they start getting physically ill. They start having headaches, nausea, some complain of forgetfulness, many symptoms, and multiple organ systems as well, because it affects the soft tissue in our body more so than the bones in our body. And so the elephant keepers have to get away from the elephants and get their break from the elephants on a regular cycle. The thing about infrasound is it's not unique to elephants. Tigers use infrasound to temporarily stun their prey and confuse their prey and increase the chances of a catch, a successful kill. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Same with bears. It's been hypothesized with wolves as well. Basically, anything that functions as an apex predator will have, it's likely that they have infrasound to kind of help with the hunt. And I think given that Bigfoot looks like an apex predator in a lot of ways, I think a lot of people believe it uses infrasound maybe to hunt, but definitely to throw us off the track, you know, people getting zapped. There's another gentleman out there who doesn't think it's infrasound zapping us, who thinks it's electromagnetic fields. You know, and again, these two theories or hypotheses, excuse me, lend themselves to research. They now have Faraday clothing that you can wear, and it blocks your electromagnetic fields being emitted for deer. I think it was specifically developed for deer, but it also protects you from incoming electromagnetic fields. With the elephant trumpets, in my book, again, I talk about an experiment that you could do in the lab where you could have a infrasound condition, expose a person to an infrasound condition, a recording of, if you've ever listened, if you want to hear something interesting, go to the Elephant Projects webpage. And on the very first part of their webpage, they have a graphic and auditory representation of an elephant trumpeting and emitting infrasound. And it is, if you close your eyes, it is uncanny how much that sounds like a Bigfoot growl. I think many people might mistake it for a Bigfoot growl, especially if you're Bigfoot naive, you know, you don't know much
about
Bigfoot.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
So you could take an audio tape like that, or if they've confirmed, if they've confirmed infrasound in like the Sierra sounds or the Ohio call, you could have an active condition where you expose the person first to the infrasound condition and measure all these physiologic stress markers and biologic markers, and then after a break, expose them to the placebo control where they're hearing the auditory trumpet or the auditory growl, but you've edited out the infrasound. So there's no infrasound there. And again, then take those physiologic measures. But other in another group, they're exposed to the placebo first, They hear the growl without any infrasound. You run your physiologic measures of stress. Then you expose that second group to the roars with the infrasound and run those stress measures and even some psychologic measures if you want to measure stress. And it that study would help, because I think the big question about being zapped is that physically happening due to a source outside of ourselves, like the electromagnetic fields or like infrasound? Or are we playing mind games with ourselves and just in the possible presence of this apex predator, basically creating a fight-flight kind of experience within our own body? And so, you know, again, that's outlined in my book how that could be done. So I think these are some of the studies that we need to be doing.
Has anyone ever analyzed the Sierra sounds for possible infrasound?
I thought they had been, but then somebody whose opinion I trust on that told me no. So honestly, I really don't know. Hmm. I thought I had heard both the Ohio calls and the Sierra sounds were analyzed for that, but I can't say. You know who would know the answer to that question, though, is Scott Nelson. Are you familiar with him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's the big, he's one of the two big crypto linguists in the field.
Yeah. The whole linguistics aspect of it is really fascinating. I sent the Sierra sounds to one of my really good friends. She studied linguistics at university. And I said, what do you think this sounds like? And she said, it's a language. It's a language. You know, I just don't know what it says, but
yeah,
it's clearly a conversation.
Yeah. And while I think people with that knowledge base, and maybe this is why Bigfoot is so exciting to so many people. You know, you don't need, if you listen to the Sierra sounds, you don't need to know all the cryptolinguistic technicalities to think, that sounds like they're talking to each other. You know, it sounds like a language. It sounds like there's an exchange going on. And it was, you know, I don't think it was surprising to anyone when that stuff was analyzed that, I know that was Tim Nelson's conclusion, that there's some form of language going on there.
Yeah, definitely. Here's a little controversial question for you. If you could say a few things to armchair critics, what would that be?
Bigfoot?
Armchair critics. People who haven't had any experiences. They don't go out in the woods. They don't go on expedition. They watch content all day and they've formed opinions.
Well, if they politely present their opinions, well, if they impolitely and in a provocative way present their opinions, I would tell them to, you know, fly off. But if, you know, if they formed an opinion, but it was an opinion that was based in genuine skepticism, you know, they examined the evidence, there's no evidence, you know, yada, 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 there's no such thing as Bigfoot. I think the most important thing to do is get out in the woods with somebody who either runs expeditions or assists with expeditions, who knows what to look for. You know, I learned a lot on my Bigfoot expeditions that it would have taken me years to learn, and I learned them just in my first expedition, because, you know, there are things you need to learn. There are things you need to know, and if you don't, you're going to end up traipsing around the woods all day, not seeing a thing, you know? And so I think the best way to sway a skeptic or sway somebody who's already decided Bigfoot doesn't exist is put them in front of one. Hopefully with a Class A, but you know, with that Class B, that bluff charge, and then I had another Class B where I was 90 feet from one growling at me and my dog. It doesn't take too many of those experiences to open you up to the possibility. I mean, I was an open skeptic to begin with. My mind wasn't made, but even if your mind's made, I've read enough accounts of people who were total disbelievers until they saw one at 100 yards or 50 yards or whatever the case may be. And that seems to quickly change opinions.
Yeah, you know, John, I didn't tell you anything about my previous experiences, but I used to spend a lot of time in the woods and hunting, fishing, hiking, 14ers here in Colorado. I used to do a lot of it alone until I started learning about this. And now, honestly, camping, I mean, I would just go out in the woods, and I went up to Crater Lake National Park and spent 2 nights in the forest alone.
Wow.
And now I think, what was I doing? I didn't know. And now that I've been listening to this kind of stuff for years now, and the more I learn, the more frightened I am to just do it alone. I mean, and I live in Colorado right now, and yeah, we have bears, we have mountain lions, we have big giant moose that will kick your butt.
Yeah.
If you get too close to moose, you know, so we have a lot of large animals here, and now we've got wolves that have been reintroduced. And yeah, it's the woods are not, you know, and it's just really interesting because, you know, I see a lot of young people, and we throw this little thing about social media into this conversation, and there's a lot of young people that are posting a lot of being outdoors. And I think that's great that people want to be outdoors, but I don't think most people really understand that it's really can be very dangerous.
The risks, yes.
And yeah. When you throw in possible running into one of these things, I mean, it's not Harry and the Hendersons, you know?
Like, yeah.
What are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
And so I personally don't want to go out there unless I have someone with me as a group.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that you had a personal habituation area. Is that on your property or?
Well, no, I say my personal, it's like I say personal because it's the one closest to me. It's a 50-minute drive from my house. But I don't own the property. It's a wildlife management property. But, you know, on most of my expeditions, I'm driving 3-4 hours to get to the base camp location for the expedition. But I've got a habituation area about 50-minute drive from where I live here in Georgia that I've had some experiences in, and I've taken other people to, and they've had experiences. So, you know, getting out in the woods, you know, you got to do your due diligence is what it boils down to. And you really can't form an opinion on Bigfoot unless you spent some time out in the woods with people who know what they're doing, because you could have been around them and never even known that they were there. The spot near my house, that's where I got growled at a Bigfoot by a Bigfoot 90 feet from behind some bushes. But before that happened, my dog lost his mind and was kind of like growling and barking at something right in front of us, like I should have seen it, but I couldn't see a darn thing. And I, at that point, I was still a bit of a skeptic about cloaking, but still open. So when I tried to go investigate what my dog was barking at, and he climbed under my trailer, when I walked out towards where he was looking, I walked out with my hands outstretched in front of me, because although I was a skeptic, I was hedging my bets just in case I would walk into it.
I love that.
I'd rather walk into a big cloak Bigfoot with my hands than do a belly bump with it. I've had, I've had that experience. I've taken another friend who, we didn't have any activity in that spot that night when we were there, but we left a long delayed recorder on, and later in the evening we got tree knocks. And then one other time, we couldn't get into that exact campground, so we took one across the street, just a little distance from it, and we had kind of the guy that I went with kind of had a paranormal kind of experience. It's increasingly known as a Bigfoot area. Which is kind of a double-edged sword. You know, part of the scientific method is reporting your results. And so how does BFRO handle that? When they get a reporter on their website, on their webpage, they put it out there for the public. And, I don't know, is that a good thing? I guess it's a good thing scientifically. Does the Bigfoot then get swamped by eager researchers and scared away? I don't know if that happens or not. But I've this Johns Mountain area that's near my house, I've tried different locations in there, and I keep coming back to this one because this one is where I get the activity. But still don't have a Class A. Not what I would call a Class A.
Well, what do you think about leaving, like the whole gift, about the gifting practice? What do you think about that? People leaving apples or tokens or whatever. Do you think that's trouble, or do you think that's a way to experiment?
I think that could be used in a way to experiment. In fact, gifting is part of the experiment I have in mind for evaluating for MindSpeak. I think there's some value in it. I think it can backfire on you. I've met some people who have started gifting stations miles and miles, one person 50 miles from their house, and the Bigfoots followed them home and started harassing them at home. Anytime you start feeding. And again, I'm using this phrase not because I believe it necessarily it's a wild creature, but anytime you start feeding anyone or anything by hand, chances are that thing is going to come around more and get used to being fed. My dad was a big hunter and fisherman, and his favorite saying was, you can take the animal out of the wild, but you can't take the wild out of the animal. And so, you know, I think there are some potential risks with gifting, but I think if you can, you know, if you're looking, again, if you're looking for that snapshot, observational science holy grail of the picture of Bigfoot, and you can disguise or hide a camera well, you know, I think that might be one way of getting that shot.
Yeah, there's a reason we don't feed bears, right?
Yeah.
Or there's a reason why hunters leave corn out in a near a tree stand, you know?
Sure.
I mean, so, they are going to come back. So, yeah, I've just heard some eyewitness accounts where people would leave apples or food, corn, you know, or whatever, and put it in a pie. And then but if you're not there to record where it goes, I think it's just anecdotal.
Yeah.
Could have been a squirrel.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with who Janice Carter is.
No.
She wrote a book with Mary Green called Tennessee Chronicles, 50 Years of Living Peacefully with Bigfoot. And Janice spent a lot of time on her granddad's farm, who found an injured baby Bigfoot and raised that Bigfoot on his farm into its adolescent and early adulthood. And Janice interacted with that thing for quite a while and developed a relationship with it. And we had a talk about gifting, and of course we talked about the foods, but she said they also appreciate things like blankets, for example, to help stay warm. For what it
makes you wonder why clothes go missing from the clothesline out in the country. You know,
although I've never heard a story of a Bigfoot wearing clothes.
Maybe the blanket.
Yeah.
I knew I hung that up here. Where did it go? Every time I hang my flannel pajamas up, they always disappear. That'd be a great way to find them.
Yeah. I think Scott Carpenter, may he rest in peace, he has since passed, to pick up on something you said earlier. In two of his books, Nephilim Among Us and Nephilim Among Us Revisited, one of his great contributions was when he went out, he would have two GoPro cameras mounted to the straps on his backpack, but instead of having them face forward, he would have them face backwards. And he was able to record things that were following him or trying to sneak up on him. And I had no fear of the forest as well until I got his book and looked at those pictures.
Oh, what's the name of his book, Scott Carpenter's?
Nephilim Among Us.
Okay. And that's a whole nother podcast, the Nephilim and the Giants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because some looked like Bigfoots, but some of it didn't look anything like Bigfoots. It looked like true monsters.
Jeez. Okay, now I got to get that book.
Yeah, so.
When did he pass?
Probably within the past 6 months.
Oh, okay. So some of the stuff was pretty recent then. I mean, it had to have been if he had GoPros and scrapped on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was within the past 20 years.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So I think that's a really great strategy as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the photographic plates. What he does in his book is he shows the raw capture, a single frame of the raw capture. Then he puts it through digital cleanup kind of stuff and shows you the cleaned up version. Then he has a third plate that is an artist rendering of it. And of course, each one is a little bit clearer.
Mm-hmm.
And
scared the crap out of me.
Where was he at? What part of the country was he in?
I think he lived in Nashville.
Okay, down Tennessee, yeah.
Yeah, so he would go to the what's there near Dollywood?
Oh, I'm not sure. But that place is so squatchy. I mean, oh my
Yeah.
God. North Car I've spent a little bit of time in North Carolina, and just driving through there, you're like, what am I gonna see? It's that's where I found all my trees, the tree structures that I saw. It was in a state park, and they were everywhere. And it's just, yeah.
I'm not, that was the big surprise for me, Monica. I was reticent to start going on Bigfoot expeditions because I had images of hiking 15 miles up a mountainside. And I am not in that condition, even when I was in better condition. But it's amazing to me, virtually every expedition I have ever been on has been, or every organized expedition I have ever been on is in either a federal wildlife management area, a national park, or a state park. And rarely do, when we do our night ops, we move away from the campsite. But we're not driving 20 miles up a hill, I
Right.
think most of the investigating we're doing is within probably 5 miles of base camp when push
Jeez.
comes to shove. So,
Well, yeah, I mean, when you think about it, we're circling back to BFRO. Like, I live in the middle of the White River National Forest, and there was a sighting not less than 2 miles from my house. And I took this winter, I started looking around for snow prints, and I believe that I found, unfortunately, the camera that I was using on my phone was crappy and the lens broke, so I
Oh
didn't get a
no.
good picture of it. I just recently got a new phone, so I'm hoping to upgrade a little bit there, but so I don't have a good picture. And I found the footprint and the snow, and then I found the smaller footprint in the snow. And it was really, really strange because I walked all around there, and it was right near where people go to walk their dogs. So my first thought was, oh, this is just a double dog print,
Yeah.
And I started looking at it. I'm like, no, this is not. It's clearly got a heel impression. It's got five toes at an angle, and the thing is about 15, 16 inches long. And then there was
Wow.
another one not too far from it. So I found a total of four tracks, two adult and two small one. But it's really strange because it's like, well, where did it go? I mean,
Yeah, just
I don't know.
disappear. Yeah.
I don't know. It was really strange. Or maybe it just got tracked over, like who knows? But right, very near houses, and yeah, I it may there more questions than answers for sure. It just keeps you going.
Yeah. One of the, I think it was Scott Carpenter who says, be sure you want to go down rabbit holes before you start doing serious
Right.
Bigfoot research because there's lots of them to go down.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm writing his name down. I'm gonna get his book. I've got Jeff Meldrum's book that I'm working on right now. Pick that up.
Awesome book.
Yeah, I made it to the Bailey, Colorado Bigfoot store. It's kind of like an icon. You go in there and so I have a couple pictures. It was just a fun place. I mean, it's
I
just
think,
trinkets and
yeah,
but that's where we got Jeff Meldrum's book.
I think he is like second or third most cited Bigfoot reference in my book. That Legend Meets Science book is an awesome book.
Yeah, it's go ahead.
I think it's unfortunate. that it ends up as bookends in a lot of people's book collection.
Oh,
and rarely gets read, but
it's not an easy read. I've tried to read it at night before I go to bed. And I'm like, I got to read this in the morning. I got to put my glasses on. I got to take notes. It is a science-based book, and it's really well done. So yeah, I look forward to reading your book too.
Oh, thank you.
yeah, to add it to that, because yeah, I love all the science stuff.
And not to compare myself to Dr. Meldrum, but you know, I've been told mine is not a real easy read either, for what it's worth. It's divided into two books, all in one book, two parts all in one book. And the second part is the tougher of the two, because it's about teaching experimental design and statistics and giving examples of that. So
I know people that would like to read that. So, well, yeah.
Available on Amazon and Hanger One Publication.
My uncle has a doctorate in biology. He's a professor emeritus in Texas. I can't remember the university. He taught it for years and years and years. And my father, actually, I just wanted to say, my father had a PhD in psychology as well. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what did he do for work then?
Well, he did more of workplace human resources type psychology things. He's since passed away a couple years ago. But I grew up listening to psychological theory and but it was neat.
It's a world unto itself, and writing this book, one of the things I realized was how out of touch I was with the psychological nomenclature being unique to psychology rather than everybody understanding it. You know, when you use these words and these concepts on a regular basis, you think everybody knows that word or everybody knows that concept. And you lose sight of kind of just how unique some of your words are and how you need to explain them. They're not, it's a language unto itself, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Academia.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so tell us the name of your book.
Oh, my book is called Grasping Sasquatch, Prepping for Scientific Field Work.
And both parts are in the same. It's one book, right?
It's one book.
It's like part one, part two.
Yeah. A couple people told me I should publish it as two separate books. But the first part, the book one, is a little lighter, a little more humorous. My humor is pretty dark, but even somebody with just a passing interest in Bigfoot might find it interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The second book is kind of for the hardcore, still in the same text, still in the same book, but this part two is kind of more for the hardcore researcher who wants to learn how to apply experimental science to investigate Bigfoot and Bigfoot phenomena. And so that's more of a technical read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like it. And then you have a documentary as well?
No. Oh, okay. Probably confusing two things. So I was slated Doug Hychek and Jeff Meldrum are putting together Legend Meets Science 2, Big Sasquatch Legend Meets Science 2. And I was slated to do regress people back to their encounters and hopefully help them retrieve more memories and deal with their encounters as part of that documentary. But so I trained the hypnotic subjects in relaxation and worked with them before filming time, but I was physically unable to make it out to film, and so somebody else actually ended up doing the regressions. But I'm told that, you know, I don't know if all of those regressions will be included in the final documentary, but some of those regressions are going to be included in the final documentary.
Interesting. So is that something that you do? The hypnosis?
I did a fair amount of it when I was in my practice and working with the vets after I closed my practice. I've been approached about it often because a lot of people, I mean, as we've discussed, a lot of people are traumatized. A lot of people have memory blanks for their experience and want to clear those things up. The big rub is you don't do, that's not something I'm comfortable doing over the internet. You need to do it face to face. I had to screen one person out because they were dealing with fresh, more recent PTSD, and to regress them back to their earlier Bigfoot trauma, we would have had to go through their war-related PTSD. And that's not something you skip over or skip around. And so the point being, there are certain risks associated with hypnosis and any form of psychotherapy, but I will not hypnotize somebody like we're talking here, you know, over the net. I want to physically be present with the person in case something pops up that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I could see there as being a just a professional thing. You know, I mean, that's just, yeah, you can't really control what happens over Zoom if that person has a psychological episode or an attack or something, and they need different kind of support. So I could see that.
I've been toying with the idea. I've done a fair number of interviews, be they, you know, whatever the platform may be. I've done a fair number of interviews, but I've only done a couple festival, conference, or expedition talks. And I've toyed with the idea of doing a workshop expedition, either on reprogramming your fight-flight response or, you know, age regression back to previous trauma, and combining that with an expedition itself, because at least then the people would be there and I could work with the people personally and face to face. But that's not something it's been something I've been kicking around, but not put together.
Yeah, I could see the value in that. That would be really interesting.
I think
it'd
be cool.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be really, it's a different way of looking at it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Especially with your background. I mean, that's your wheelhouse.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is. Yeah.
Well, different people have different views of psychology. Some people are even skeptical when I talk about how you can reprogram your fight flight response so you don't poop and pee in your drawers and you can remain calmer and be less likely traumatized. People don't believe it. No way. You know, they're skeptical about even that. But it works. We can get some control or be able to better manage that automatic fight flight response. It doesn't have to result in complete loss of control if you put in some time on the front end to learn how to modulate that.
You know, I wanted to say something, and maybe you can back me up on this, or maybe it's just I'm pretty sure this is true. So I did some EFT training, and one of the things that I learned, and then I correlated this with listening to people's experiences and accounts of things that they clearly were traumatized about on different podcasts. And if you listen to someone's speech, if they say things like, if they say things in the present tense, then they're actually still reliving that trauma. But if they say it in the past tense, like, I saw a Bigfoot versus I'm standing right here and he's standing in front of me and he's breathing heavily, you're still in that trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So if the listeners here start paying attention to some of these experiences, I mean, the people that are saying things in the present tense, like, that's a real thing. That's the dead giveaway for me that person's being authentic.
Yeah.
Because they are in that moment and they're still repeating that over and over and over. And it's no wonder that these people are traumatized.
Yeah.
So I can having a valid a way to help people.
Yeah. At the risk of looking ignorant myself, I'm not, you said EFT?
Sorry, it was on silent. Emotional freedom technique. It's similar to EMDR, but it's
okay.
I did a whole study on it. I was in school for health coaching, and I chose that as a topic because I had tried it myself and got a lot of benefit out of it. But there's the protocol where it's tapping on certain acupressure points, and then you say certain things to walk yourself through your trauma. And it, because, you know, we hold it in our bodies, right? I mean, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk did work on The Body Keeps the Score, right?
Right.
So it's definitely a very good thing. And if anyone is, I just wanted to mention that, because if there are people who have had these experiences and they haven't noticed that they're saying these things in the present tense and they're still traumatized about it, you can work through that and find professionals such as yourself.
There's a few, and again, I don't know how the logistics of this are going to work out, but there is, and I'm sorry I don't have her name, there is a therapist or a psychologist who specialized in PTSD trauma for a long time, who's putting together a treatment center for people with cryptid PTSD specifically.
Oh, that is so, wow.
And I know one of the people that's working with her doing that, but I don't have his permission to share his name over air. But, you know, there are psychologists that are open-minded enough to be thinking about this and mm-hmm. wanting to help people with, you know, the trauma that sometimes comes with it. You know, on a few of my podcasts or YouTube shows, we talked about PTSD and trauma, and one of the people who edited and critiqued my book pointed out that not everybody has a traumatic experience with Bigfoot. Some people actually have pleasant experiences with Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And spiritual experiences with Bigfoot. And so I'm just throwing that out there just because I think that's an important perspective to consider. You know, of course, as a psychologist, I'm a retired psychologist now, but as a psychologist, my bias is to help with what's went wrong, or pathology, if you will. But the flip side is on the chapters on reprogramming your fight flight, the chapters on learning to relax, learning to do visualization, learning to do self-hypnosis, learning to do stress inoculation in my book, that's all to prevent Bigfoot PTSD. You get ahead of it and do those things before you go out, and you're going to be less likely to be traumatized. But, you know, there's a need for people that have had traumatic experiences, and some of them have been, some of them have been Bigfooting for decades, and then all of a sudden it sneaks up on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very real. I don't think there should be any debates about whether it's legit or not. I guess because there's a debate about Bigfoot, maybe that's why there's a debate about...
It's a debate about everything.
Bigfoot PTSD, but...
All the haters out there.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. Well, I guess we've got to park this car pretty soon and get pretty late where you are, I'm sure. And so
enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, this has been really really great. Really enjoyed this. And so drop a little information about where people can find you and your book and all that good stuff.
Grasping Sasquatch, prepping for scientific field work is available on Amazon and on Hangar One at Hangar One Publications, which can also be networked through the Untold Radio Network, which is Doug Hychek's deal. My 36 episode YouTube channel broadcasts are still available on YouTube, and their foundation for them is the book itself, my book itself, and that's called Grasping Sasquatch Stories and Science. Basically, I would tell or read a story and then tie it into some kind of scientific principles or issues. And I don't have like a business page or a member page or anything like that. My name's John Baranchok, B-A-R, well, you can see it's spelled B-A-R-A-N-C-H-O-K. And so that's my Facebook page, and that's where I do most of my ranting and raving about Bigfoot. The one big plug I will put out there is I'm looking for speaking engagements and if anybody listening knows of anybody needing a good speaker, I'd be happy to attend to share my perspectives and propaganda.
I think Phenomicon's still open for speakers. You should go check out their page in Utah.
Okay. Okay,
yeah,
Utah.
I got my ticket. Yep, I got my tickets February 1st. Right when I was like, "I'm ready, I'm ready, I'm getting my ticket."
When is that?
It is September.
Oh, okay.
I cannot remember the actual dates. It's September, like I don't know. It's on the. I don't have it in front of me. Of course,
I'll check it out. Okay.
Yeah, it's Phenomicon, and they have all of their information up, and get tickets. Even if you can make it just to see it, it's such, it's truly amazing. Huge. Yeah. And it gets bigger and bigger every year. This will be my second year going. And I had withdrawal for weeks afterward. I was just like, I'm in the portal now. I don't know where I'm at, but I'm not on Earth. So.
Do they have a specific cryptid or Bigfoot section, or were you all mixed up?
It's heavy on the, you know, because it's right near I actually went to Skinwalker Ranch and had an experience there.
Neat.
It was pretty crazy. I met the crew. I met Tony Merkel, of the confessionals. I got to meet him. It was truly fascinating. Dr. Maria Mayer, Russell Acord, nice. Jay Stratton was there. I mean, a lot of paranormal groups were there. Yeah, all the biggies. I met George Knapp. I got to listen to a speech from him and have they had a luncheon with him.
Nice.
I met Nick Pope. I mean, you name it. It was awesome. Oh. So as soon as tickets opened up, I was like ready with my mouse. Like, I'm getting tickets.
Hey,
can't wait.
I'll check it out.
I think they may still have tickets, so I'm not sure. But yeah, I think that they're still open for, because the way that they do it is they have like their core people that do speaking engagements, and then they just build on until September and they keep adding people. So if you are interested, reach out to the organizers for sure.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I'd love to see you there. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on and sharing your wisdom and your insight and all the science and all the research and your book. And it's been really awesome.
Well, thank you, Monica. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and happy to come back anytime if you need some slots to fill. I could talk. Well, I literally talked for about 50 hours on my show. So
let's talk about giants next. Let's go there. Yeah, awesome. All right, thank you, John.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to another great episode. Be sure and like, share, or follow this podcast by leaving a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have an experience you'd like to share, be sure and reach out to verbalecho@gmail.com. If you know someone who'd like to tell their story, please send them our way. I want to talk to them. No guardrails. Have a great week, friends. See you in the next episode.